This means that Donald Trump will be the 45th president of the United States.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hello and welcome to this week's 45th podcast. I'm here this week with Watch. Hey, Watch.
Hey, how's it going?
And Siraj, who for this week and this week alone is excused for not being up to date entirely on the news.
Hey, what's going on?
So how have you been, Siraj?
I'm good. I just got married.
Yeah.
For those who follow.
Congratulations. I hear that you were just on your honeymoon.
Yeah, I got back from Key West
nice.
And just wasn't. The first thing I saw when I logged onto Twitter was Twitter going crazy from Eric Swalwell allegedly farting on live television.
It was the greatest thing that's ever happened. We will never have a moment like that again.
I laughed out loud maybe like 8 times. I saw that tweet on replay. I'm not going to apologize.
Let's be real. It's never not funny when fart jokes enter politics.
The quality of the fart.
But see, now I find myself being a fart truther because I think Swalwell's innocent.
You know, even if he didn't do it, like, I would have just said, yeah, I ripped it.
I know, it's much funnier that way.
You know, let the joke keep going. And I think, honestly, Swalwell would do himself a huge favor if he just, like, owned up to it because, you know, a lot of people, like me, I really appreciate people who have self-deprecating senses of humor. And if you just be like, yeah, I farted, you know, who cares? It happens. It's the human body.
But then Chris Wallace would get away with it.
Yeah, but do we know if it's Swalwell?
We don't know. He says it's not. I think after reviewing the evidence, it was not him.
I'm hoping it's him.
Me too.
It's just like hoping Obama's a Muslim.
I agree with Siraj. I tweeted that. I said, like, if I was an elected official or if I wasn't, like, you know, if I wasn't in that position, I would own that fart because you would actually be like popular in America. Like if you could just go on SNL, SNL and own that fart, do a sketch. Everyone will love you. Like your ratings will go up. You could be president.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's like I feel like Swalwell dropped out of the race too soon because if he had just like let
that
his
moment,
fart...
he could win Iowa right now. If he handled the fart right, Iowa would be his.
Think of the fart bump that would have happened to him in the polls. I mean. It's unfortunate, really, but, you know, here we are Tuesday morning quarterbacking, you know, thinking about all the possibilities of the Swalwell presidential campaign had he just stayed in the race and owned up to that fart.
This is clearly the most important thing that happened in American politics this week.
This is true.
but
that is what I entered into politics to this week. So that's and then, of course, the everything with the deluge of impeachment hearings, which has been, I guess, entertaining. I don't know. You guys got to tell me. Catch me off the speed.
But the fact that Swalwell was able to then tie it back to what's happening with capital letters, he said totally exonerated when the MSNBC account actually said that it was not a fart, but allegedly that mug being dragged across the countertop. Mm.
Now that is a lie.
Just explaining it away like that makes it sound like there actually was a fart and they're trying to cover it up.
Oh, there was definitely a fart. I will never believe it was a mug or a phone like they were saying. We need a special counsel.
Yeah, we do need a special counsel. Yes, absolutely.
Can I just share my commitment to Fartgate that I actually then took a mug and dragged it to see if I could replicate the sound? And no, there was no fart. That was a classic.
I got a mug right here. Let's do this.
Let's hear it.
That's not no.
You gotta obviously take into account the surface you're dragging it on, and you have to have an independent variable. Okay, we gotta do this like you gotta apply the scientific method here.
Well, in other news, lesser important things happened this week. Roger Stone's trial concluded, and he was convicted on all counts. Unsurprisingly, it was. I mean, you know, you never know when a trial is going to happen, but it seemed like a foregone conclusion that this would be the result. And in fact, his defense was really not even, I didn't do it. I mean, the whole strategy for Roger Stone now has been to look for a pardon. That's what he wants.
I mean, that's a pretty valid strategy for him to go with, given the fact that one of his very close personal friends happens to be in charge of that particular action.
He should go commit a war crime, then he might get it.
Well, given the fact that this impeachment inquiry and the hearings are already happening, Trump should just say fuck it and just do it.
No, we absolutely should not. That would be a disaster.
I'm just saying, like, politically speaking, like, sure, it'll hurt him. But at this juncture, like, he's already in the impeachment hearings right now. So, you know, just do it and be legends, right? I mean, that seems to be the Trump strategy. And, you know, whatever happens, just let the dice fall where they may. People will probably get really upset with him. And then that next week, we'll all forget about it.
See, it does apply a lot of the time, but from a lot of most of the stuff he does, he knows that Republicans will support him. There are exceptions, there are conflicts, but for the most part, Republicans, if they do object strongly, they can stop him on things. There's a reason he didn't fire Mueller, because Republicans, that didn't align too far for them. Pardoning Manafort or Stone, yeah, that's
is
not going to fly. Yeah, that is.
No, that's Susan, seriously though.
Yeah.
I mean, not to be like devil's advocate here, but like, is it really that far for Republicans?
I think part of what he's trying to do with these pardons he's been doing the past couple of years is lay the groundwork for eventually trying to pardon them. I think he will do it one day. Yeah. I think right now would be a disaster for him.
I mean, he's openly talked about pardoning him.
Yeah, so like, he has, but hasn't done it.
I mean, sure, that's memorable to folks who are sort of like covering this.
Yeah, but Republicans always do the, oh, he's just talking, doesn't mean it. And then he goes in and does it, and they're like, oh, well, I guess he didn't mean it. But I do think it would be politically a disaster, and it wouldn't be something that just flew by. I think right now is the worst time he could do it, because he would lose support from Republicans, and for him it's very important to have like a unified front. That would very much damage it. Plus, the whole thing is, Roger Stone is going to be in prison, or at least he's going to get a sentence, for lying to cover up Trump's connections to Russia and the email hacking and release.
What's interesting, though, is that you know how they always talk about the cover-up being worse than the crime? I don't know.
The crime's pretty bad here.
Well, the cover-up is obviously way worse, in my opinion. I don't know. The thing is, and Susan, I know you and I probably disagree on this and to the terms of which Trump's actual ties are to Russia.
Well, there was one that he lied about because he knew it was damaging.
And so I feel like the lying has obviously, and the people who have lied on his behalf have been far more damaging to his credibility than, say, the actual connections that he may or may not have had to, say, Vladimir Putin.
That's interesting. You think that the four people now who are going to go face jail time are already in prison for lying to hide Trump's Russia connections, that was the real problem and that his Russia connections weren't the issue.
Yeah.
Interesting theory. Okay, so how many people have to go to prison for trying to hide Trump's Russia connections before it becomes apparent to you or very likely to you that, in fact, there are Russia connections that Trump wants to hide?
I mean, like, I guess this is my belief of the Trump campaign. I feel like they were just too disorganized and almost, I mean, it was a circus, really, during the 2016 campaign.
Yes, it was.
I feel like it's just impossible for me to believe that a campaign like Trump's 2016 campaign was just so badly managed that operating in trying to, you know, orchestrate tilting an election with the help of the Russian government.
It was a good conspiracy and Russia was doing the heavy lifting.
Yes, it's called being a useful idiot. And it's also
and that's certainly the possibility, but I don't think. Again, like, I feel like a lot of these people were probably working on Trump's behalf without him actually knowing what was going on. And if he did, I think we've talked about, I guess, in the last few days, or at least over the weekend, Trump went to Walter Reed Medical Center. And I think people were wondering about his fitness. I mean, he is, 73 years old?
Okay, well, literally, though, Roger Stone just became a convicted criminal because he lied about telling Trump about where the emails are coming from and when they were coming.
So yeah, I just feel like Trump doesn't remember stuff.
Okay, so your defense of him is that he is a helpless idiot.
Yeah.
Let's impeach him. I'm down with impeaching him for that, too.
I mean, they possibly could impeach him for that. And I'm not saying I'm defending the guy. I just feel like...
You just think he's too stupid to do anything wrong.
He's just such a goof sometimes. It's so hard for me to believe that he actually could pull this off.
I'm not saying this lightly, but like they literally said that about Hitler.
What?
Yeah. That he's a bumbling buffoon. I disagree.
Yeah, they literally said he's not going to be able to kill the Jews because he's a bumbling buffoon and he's just trying to talk and get attention.
This is how Muslim, you know, to be honest, this is how Muslim conspiracy theorists kind of denied initially that Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda did 9/11. I'm serious because they said Muslims are so incompetent as a group that there's no way working.
I mean, like long-term threat.
I'm serious. I'm telling you straight up. This is what some Muslims said. There's no way that Muslims could have done 9/11 because it required such long-term planning and strategy that to hijack the planes and to like coordinate it is just beneath us. We're so incompetent as a people. We're so stupid. We're always late to parties. There's no way we could pull it off. And I think, you know, it's the mistake that we've always made when we say, oh, the adults in the room, we have to count on Mattis and Kelly and Tillerson. Donald Trump is a grown-ass man. He's 73 years old. And his entire history, his career as a businessman, his career as a reality TV star, is all the facts that we have shown is that there is a malice there, a recklessness there, an inherent disregard for norms and ethics and just rules. And now he is, if you will, emboldened by the presidency. And one thing connecting to Roger Stone and his conviction is now that there's going to be apparently maybe new impeachable offenses added because the House is suggesting that Donald Trump actually lied to Robert Mueller when it came to actually knowing whether or not there was information coming from WikiLeaks, right? So I think this defense is actually impeachable. I agree with Susan because it shows that this president is so idiotic and incompetent that he like is a bumbling buffoon and should be removed from office. Or what I think is that there is a inherent corruption and disregard for laws and facts. And what's worse is he doesn't really seem to care, right? Like, I'll give you one quick example, right? The Dole Resort. Like, while this was all happening, he goes, I'm going to do the G7 at Dole. And we're like, wait, what? Why can't I do it? I'm the president. So it's almost like he believes he is above the law.
Oh, no, I don't disagree with that sentiment at all. I think there is equal combinations of Trump being buffoonish and then equal parts of him being in many ways so interested in self-preservation and boosting his own brand and kind of considering himself to be above the law. That's, I mean, kind of the accusation that many people threw at Hillary Clinton over her email server was that she felt she was above the law and she was not subject to federal oversight.
Yes, that's clearly proof that they're equivalent.
No, I mean, I'm just saying that it was a similar accusation that because they did not abide by say certain federal parameters or federal laws.
My favorite part of the impeachment hearing so far was when I think it was Sondland. He was talking about why he used his like private WhatsApp account to do government business. He's like, well, the state email is so cumbersome, I didn't want to use it. I'm like,
yeah,
well.
I mean, for someone like Gordon Sondland, I mean, he should, I think the law
no one cared.
Should obviously
no one
be
cared.
Applied.
No one cares. Deeply.
And yeah, no one does care. And that's
they only care because it's Hillary.
Temperature is personal, and everyone's idea of the comfortable temperature is unique. Some of us, like me, are particularly hard to please. I have a thing called Raynaud's, which means that if I get the tiniest bit of a chill, my hands and feet instantly turn purple and white. Also means that I often find myself during the day making a cup of coffee that I have no interest in drinking, I just want to hold a mug. That's why I love the Ember Wave. The Ember Wave is the first bracelet that helps you feel colder or warmer at the press of a button. And that comes in handy because often during the day you find yourself somewhere where you can't control the temperature. While traveling, in the airport, in airplanes especially, or in the movie theaters, sometimes the temperature is not great. That's why Ember Wave can help, because it's there when you need relief the most. All you do is press to activate Ember Wave for a burst of heating or cooling. This sensation pairs with your body and mind to make you feel more comfortable in a matter of minutes. Ember Wave provides comfort in unpredictable climates, relief from stress, and support for sleep. And at the end of the day, Ember Wave has a fall asleep mode that can help you maintain a comfortable temperature as you drift off to sleep. So if there's someone in your life like me, who is always struggling with the cold, don't get them more socks this year. Get them Ember Wave. Seriously, it is the best device for dealing with this. And for this Black Friday Cyber Monday sale, listeners get $60 off if they go to emberwave.com/45th. That's emberwave.com/45th.
let's recap the past week and a bit of the public impeachment hearings. Last week, we had, to start off with, we had Bill Taylor, the chargé for Ukraine, and George Kent, the senior State Department official, who testified together to save time and to speed run this impeachment. For some reason, they are doubling up on witnesses, which is more efficient. And they testified, Sunday last week, Tuesday. That sounds right. And their testimony was, I think it was a good call to make them first. I think that was, I mean, if this was a trial, which is not, those are the kind of witnesses you want to have first in the stand to sort of lay out the groundwork, tell some interesting parts of the story, but to give a broader view of what will be laid out over the next, you know, few weeks in this case. I guess you were too busy lounging around on the beach in Key West. You didn't
I got the highlight reel. I mean, look.
I watched. I'm the nerd. I watched. Pick on me, teacher.
What I can imagine, though, is, and look, I think Trump tweeting during these testimonies, specifically during Marie Yovanovitch's testimony, I don't know why he's doing it. He's just shooting himself in the foot.
You know why.
I mean, he does it because he feels the need to.
He's impulsive, yeah.
Yeah, he's impulsive. He feels compulsed to do it.
But it's also intimidating. It's also witness intimidation.
But
you
notice
know?
He didn't tweet during the two dudes who were testifying the first day. I think after the fact he did like call.
Did attack Jennifer Williams, another woman.
Yeah.
And a current aide to Mike Pence.
That's the best part. Current aide. He's still the current aide.
We'll see how long that lasts. I mean, I'm
sure
they're
probably. We'll see how long any of them last.
If they expel her from the government, then you know the jig is up. But if anything, what they're going to do is probably just reassign her to a different part of the federal government.
Yeah, that's what they'll do. But Morrison got kicked out.
Well, Morrison resigned. He resigned because he knew jig was up. So, yeah, I mean, it's important. Because Tim Morrison, they see him as kind of a, you know, they see him as an ally. They see him as like a right-wing hawk. Tim Morrison, who's testifying. We're recording this today on Tuesday.
Unfortunately, right now, right as we're doing this. Yeah, yes. I'm not annoyed at all that I timed this recording for during testimony. That was not a dumb call by me or anything.
But, you know, the reason why the Republicans like him is because he has said allegedly that he didn't think the phone call was wrong. And he, you know, he is a little bit critical of Vindman, who just gave damning testimony today for those of you who listened. But even Morrison, their good witness, who we'll get to, it's still like they got him dead to rights because he throws Sondland under the bus.
Yeah, the Sondland bus throwing is going to be like a new Olympic event.
Yeah, like how much masochism can Sondland survive? He'll throw himself under the bus. Then he'll correct himself.
Yeah, and remember the text messages that were released by the House Intelligence Committee in early October, I believe it was, between Bill Taylor and Gordon Sondland? Mm-hmm. It was sort of like, I think at that moment, most people were looking at that particular exchange because it was centered around the actual call between Zelensky and Trump. As sort of like this, almost like the smoking gun, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, do you guys recall that?
It's all Volker's. We don't have enough. Volker's the only one who actually was able to keep his text and had them to share because the State Department has refused to release any of the materials that it has for most people. So right now we have a tiny fraction. Basically, all we have is what Volker had, and he didn't even have his full collection because to date, State Department is not going to release any of it. So
but it revealed that the text itself revealed. That Taylor was essentially creating a record in real time.
Yeah. So Taylor's testimony, you know, I mean, they were solid witnesses. They're both of them in their career. Both of them, I think, showed what this was. It was people doing their jobs in the U.S. government who had no desire to get involved in anything. They're not never Trumpers, despite Trump's tweeting about that. They're just doing a job or trying to. And they don't want this drama. They don't want to be there. They don't want impeachment. They don't want, all they want is to do their job and have the Ukraine policy that the U.S. has had for a long time now. And that was getting interfered with. So Kent didn't speak as much, I don't think, overall. But what Taylor could talk to was his interactions with Volker and Sondland. And one, why what Trump was doing was so destructive, why it's important for us to have a Ukraine policy that supports Ukraine, and how Trump's actions damage that.
Yeah, and I think Ambassador Taylor, again, if you go back and read his 15-page opening statement, which I think everyone really should, especially those who want to be public servants, it's a really a great testament to why people serve. He served for 50 years for both Republican and Democratic administrations. And that point about why it's so important for Ukraine, like he brings it back to the fact that this is like a national security issue. Russia has invaded and is attacking Ukraine as we speak. and more than 13,000 Ukrainians have died. So this aid that was held up deliberately by the Trump administration, this $391 million, actually hurt our alliance with Ukrainians who were dying as a result. And I think that's a point that people kind of gloss over.
The thing is, Ukrainian foreign policy has been traditionally one of the few areas now that is genuinely bipartisan and with very little division between Republican and Democrat, because almost everyone agrees that we don't want Russia to be annexing, invading all its neighbors, starting up new land wars. It's a pretty firm agreement across the board. There's not like a Democrats want this, Republicans want this. Like everyone, with a few exceptions, wants the same thing, which is for Ukraine to be strong, free, democratic, and not get smashed by Russia. Now, the exceptions, unfortunately, are one, Donald Trump, and two, everyone on Fox News.
I think you've actually had a few more people who have been a bit more, not critical of Trump, but been giving a bit more credibility to the impeachment inquiry. I think Chris Wallace was a good
example. I'm talking about Russia policy solely, and mostly Tucker, because I watched his show after their testimony, and I was honestly horrified by how much Tucker Carlson was telling all his viewers that we don't care. Like he fully said, like, why are we even over there? Why do we care if Russia wants to take over Ukraine? Let them, right. Doesn't bother us.
I mean, he's a pure America firster. So, I mean, in terms of, I mean, he's of the Rand Paul foreign policy brand.
I don't even know if Rand Paul before 2016 was, let's let Russia invade its neighbors. That's cool with us. It's not good for us in any way.
Yeah, I mean, I would say probably when it comes to European foreign policy, I think you have libertarians and Republicans like Rand Paul and probably Tucker Carlson who are a bit more hands-on in terms of wanting to control the dynamic there because it serves America's interests. But if you look at like Middle East policy, like you have Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, Syria, and Libya, just get the hell out of there. That's pretty much been the whole, I think, libertarian foreign policy that Rand Paul and Tucker Carlson sort of subscribe to.
Well, traditionally, the idea that we don't care if Russia invades and annexes neighbors, it doesn't bother us. That's an insane idea that is largely rejected, but unfortunately not as big audience through Fox. Anyway, the next day was Marie Yovanovitch, who testified by herself. And of course, after the day one of testimony, there was all those articles like, what was the best? The best one was like, day one of impeachment lacks pizzazz.
Oh, yeah.
It was actually a really exciting hearing. Like, I thought it was.
Unfortunately, Jonathan Allen, who otherwise is actually a good reporter, just wrote this piece that got dragged, rightfully so. Yeah, yeah. He said, like, it lacked pizzazz. And it's harkening back to that terrible commentary that emerged right after the Mueller hearings about optics. And then Reuters had another one. Similarly about like, oh, it wasn't flashy, even though the ratings were like gangbusters, 13 million people tuned in. And
it's not supposed to be reality TV. I mean, it's a damn impeachment hearing.
And it was also like an exciting hearing, that aside. Like one, it shouldn't be judged that way. And two, it was pretty exciting. Anyway.
There was a great, you guys watched that viral clip that went where the woman was sitting in an airplane. And she just panned left to right, and every single screen on the airplane was watching CNN's Mary Yovanovitch a testimony. That was the comeback to It Lacks Pizzazz. Like everybody saw it. And Yovanovitch got a standing ovation after the hearing was over. So yeah, pretty thrilling, I would say. Thrilling and exciting. That's what Jihad Ali's critical quote. Two thumbs up.
Yeah, I mean it's kind of interesting. I mean, a lot of people are fixating on this bit from Yovanovitch about Trump's intent about being intimidating. And it's kind of interesting how some of his defenders seem to want to believe that Trump was not being intimidating, or at least Trump believes that. And it sort of reminds me of all those times where, you know, you get into arguments with family members and you think they're yelling at you and they're like, no, I'm not yelling at you, while they're clearly yelling at you. It's always about the perception and never about, like, for Trump, he just never understands what tone and what he's putting out there that people perceive as being intimidating or threatening. It's just kind of, I guess it's just a weird anecdotal analysis that I just feel like Trump just doesn't understand how he comes off to people.
On the other hand, I would say he does it because he understands, and that his way of fighting back, he calls it fighting back, is to go on Twitter and yell at them. He's used his Twitter his whole life, well, since he's had Twitter, to do this. Anyone pisses him off, he goes on and rages at them and tries to silence them. Like, that's not just a habit. I mean, it is a habit, but he knows he can try and yell people down, scare them off. That's what he's doing. The defense that he wasn't being threatening is a remarkable indictment of his own presidency, because if you're saying the president is so weak and helpless that him insulting and like attacking you publicly for the whole world to see is not intimidating, I mean,
it's a very deliberate strategy that he has cultivated that was given to him by his previous advisor and mentor, Roy Cohn, who he threw under the bus, and also Roger Stone, right? Attack, 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 deny, deny, deny. Never, ever apologize, because apologies show weakness, so you always counterattack.
Yovanovitch definitely helped herself out during her testimony by not trying to get into the specifics of what she thought the president's intent was, but at least
she was able to speak to
what she felt during that time in which she felt she was being intimidated.
And it was a masterful move by Schiff to, in real time, bring up the tweet, read it, and then get her her live response.
Yeah, and Fox News, they were saying that really the only one guilty of witness intimidation is Schiff, because if he hadn't read her the tweet, she wouldn't have known about it.
I mean, you know, the really sad part is, as we talk about where we are right now with this impeachment hearing, is that the Republicans really have not attacked the facts at all, because they just can't. So they've attacked the process. Remember that?
Right.
They invaded the Schiff hearing with the cell phones, which was a security threat, and then Matt Gaetz ordered pizza, and then he left. They've been attacking, you know, the vote, and then Pelosi and Democrats held the vote. Then they punted, and now they're attacking the messengers. And today they're saying, and you know, literally today what they're saying during Vindman, basically they were saying they were attacking like the advisors and like how the White House works, and pretty much making the case that the Trump is like a moron who has no idea who's like in the White House or advising him. But they are incapable of A, attacking the facts, and B, they seem to be not perturbed at all that Trump could have actually bribed and extorted a foreign country to interfere in our domestic elections. And this is why 70% of Americans, according to the study that came out just yesterday, the poll, think what Trump did was wrong. And 51%, which is actually a stunning number, guys, 51% want him impeached and removed. And it's only November. I mean, just to give you a historical comparison, right? At the beginning of the Watergate hearings, it was only 19% of Americans want an impeachment. It was like 13 months later, after all the evidence came out, where it went to like 58%. We're already at 51%, and it's not getting better.
Yeah, no, it's Pelosi, I think, has played her cards pretty well here in the last few months, because remember, I think it was about at least 2 months ago. It was like right around before she gave her blessing to the impeachment inquiry in that kind of historic speech or remarks, I think, in late September. What was interesting here, though, is that the more coverage this has been getting, the more Americans are obviously tuning into it, because it's dominating the news cycle. And you're getting witnesses who are career federal employees, career federal government employees, who, for one, don't really have a track record of being partisans, and basically have been working in whether it be national security or foreign policy or State Department, what have you. There's been sort of that recurring narrative that Trump seems to be using his office for his own political gain. And then to what extent does the public believe that that is in the wrong, and that's something that a president should be removed over? It's kind of interesting seeing how the polls are starting to increase more and more. Back in like June and May, it was like 20-25% support impeachment and removal, and already it's doubled. It's crazy. One thing I did want to point out, though, and this is just with respect to how, you know, Pelosi's messaging and Democrats' messaging overall. You know, over the last two and a half years, Trump has sort of gone after Democrats as calling them obstructionists. And then here you have this minority House Republican caucus sort of going out and obstructing as much as they possibly can, you know, in terms of like invading the SCIF and all those moves, in terms of like not asking actually substantive questions, but sort of, you know, like you're given like a 5-minute question period, and all you're doing is going on a political rant. Like, that just, it just looks like they're not interested at all about getting to the truth of the matter, or more so just pointing out that this is a drudged up witch hunt by the Democrats. And while you certainly can't rule out that there are certain parts of the investigation or the impeachment inquiry that have been mishandled or poorly handled, as we're seeing in this last week and a half, that things seem to be going south for Trump and the Republican base.
All I can say is thank God they came to their senses and agreed to have questioning by dedicated questioners for longer than 5-minute periods, because ain't nothing would have gotten done if they had stuck with the usual format. However, that being said, the Republicans' choice of questioner is somewhat baffling. For the Democrats, it's Goldman. He's been pretty no-nonsense. He's not a flashy questioner, but he's effective. You can tell he's a prosecutor, former prosecutor. He's just good at, you know, the act of asking questions. Steve Castor, I think his name is, the Republicans' questioner, who before at the start of each witness has 45 minutes per side to, you know, get into details of their testimonies. Oh my God, he's terrible. He's so bad. Have you seen?
He's got nothing.
But he's like not even like about. I'm not even talking about the substance. I'm not talking about his positions or the GOP positions. I'm talking about, like, content aside, he's just objectively dreadful.
And also, today. With Vindman, he had nothing, so he really brought out an ugly kind of anti-Semitic conspiracy, trying to tie Vindman to Ukraine and suggesting a dual loyalty and double agency. It goes back to our point when you cannot, like, because, you know, we're both attorneys, you're actually a practicing attorney, but, you know, we've been in cases where the facts just aren't there. So you throw whatever you can and hope it sticks. They just have nothing. And I give Republicans credit that they're really good at messaging, because they are.
Well, that's what Castor was doing. He wasn't doing cross-examination. He wasn't doing a fact inquiry. He was trying to get sound bites for the Republican messaging machine, which is very much centered on, like, for Yovanovitch, it was that she's an emotional, like, crybaby, never-trupper whiner, deep stater. For Vindman, it's he's a dual agent who's really loyal to Ukraine first and America second, if at all.
Yeah, but I'm saying is, it's remarkable that since October, nothing has really stuck on the wall. And you know, because it just gets swatted away. And it just shows you, like, the more they're just, like, as Siraj was saying, they're sinking more and more to the bottom. And Trump doesn't do them any favors, right? Just these self-destructive acts.
And the reason for that is because there haven't been many holes to punch through their stories. I mean, the thing is,
bureaucrats are incredibly boring.
Well, no, I was just going to say, I mean, everything centering around that Trump-Zelensky call in July, I mean, say what you want about, like, what if you actually believe that Joe Biden and his son Hunter sort of did something shady in Ukraine or possibly in China, the fact of the matter that Trump is trying to leverage foreign or U.S. aid money to Ukraine in exchange for conducting this investigation. I mean, people keep talking about, oh, quid pro quos happen all the time in foreign policy. Yes, that is true. Quid pro quos do happen all the time. But I think this one particular case in which he's trying to target one of his possible 2020 opponents in the general election, like, that raises a bunch of red flags. I think there was one reporter, I'm trying to remember who it was. He asked, I think in October, he asked President Trump during one of his pool sprays, asking, have you ever asked any foreign governments to investigate anyone who wasn't one of your political rivals? And that was just, and he couldn't answer it. And that was the perfect question, the perfect follow-up to ask Trump, because he seems to be on this, he claims to want to just investigate corruption, yet it only seems to happen with his political rivals.
And yet he never mentioned corruption otherwise. Like, he was supposed to bring up corruption, like the anti-corruption programs more generally, and he did not. I mean, the more concerning thing is the Republicans have, at least in the Intel Committee and the ones on Fox News, have largely circled around to the defense that what Trump did was not wrong and are lobbying hard to get the public to buy that. and they'll succeed to some degree, hopefully not too much. But it is really concerning that one of two political parties in the U.S. has now embraced the president's right to request foreign states investigate his rivals. I mean, today they were openly saying that that was his policy right to do. It was a preference. It was a policy issue, and he could choose to do that.
Yeah, we predicted that last week, right? Because we're looking at the fact patterns. And you're saying, okay, they're attacking the process, didn't work. You're attacking the messengers, not working. There's literally no fact because it's airtight and the narrative has been corroborated now by sterling witnesses. So the only end game here, and this is literally the only end game for Republicans. Yes, Trump bribed or extorted, and he has every right to because he's Trump and the president.
Oh, no, he didn't bribe because he never said the word bribe. So therefore, it's not bribery.
Oh, yeah. So he can pressure. Yes, Trump pressured.
No, there's no pressure.
Oh, he asked. Whatever it is, at the end of the day, look, I'm being more cynical. I'm saying at the end of the day, so what if Trump bribed or extorted or pressured? He has every right to do it. He's the president of the United States of America, and it's okay to accept foreign interference. Clinton and Obama would have done it as well, and he was cracking down on corruption, and it's the deep state conspiracy. Period. Move on. Let's vote. 2020. Yeah,
there has been a lot of, and this is the thing, I think, I don't know if many Republicans are still on this simply because I've been out of the loop for the last 10 days. But one of the predictions that everyone has sort of had is that if Democrats were going to impeach Trump, they would do it in the confines or in the context of the 2020 presidential election so that when people go to the ballot, should they actually go and vote for articles of impeachment and say it gets passed the House, there's at least a new messaging that Democrats can use to say this president is currently under investigation or is it currently under impeachment and you shouldn't vote for him. That's been the strategy here. It's kind of fascinating to see that it's actually, I think, at least from my perception, it's working out better for Democrats than I think they would have expected because you're having people like Bill Taylor, like Marie Yovanovitch, like Alexander Vindman, come through and actually give testimony that doesn't scream out being partisan or political operatives.
They're letting the public see the deep state. And it turns out the deep state is really wonky and serious.
Well, I mean, it didn't work out well for them with the Mueller probe. I mean, when you had people like Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, I mean, that
they weren't
really
involved at all when they were testifying.
That hurt Democrats politically, obviously, because of the perceived bias of the Mueller probe.
They weren't even on the Mueller probe, though.
They were removed, yes, but it was just sort of kind of it left that stain on the Mueller probe that it wasn't just Strzok, it wasn't just Page, it's basically the entire team.
But see, they're doing the same thing now, and it will work to some degree.
So you know why it won't work? Because right now, as we were talking, Kurt Volker is testifying.
God, why did I freaking agree to record right now? That was so stupid of me.
But check it out. Volker is the Republican witness, and he has blown a hole in the Republican case because he threw Giuliani under the bus, and he vouched for Biden.
Volker saving his own ass because he's not Sondland, but he also is in dicey territory. He is saying some very much untrue things.
Massive dicey territory. But what I'm saying is, I mean, Siraj has a point that the disinformation campaign, the distraction actually did taint the whole Mueller report and hearing and struck. But right now, even when you have Volker straight up helping the case against Trump and Giuliani, that is not a strong position for Republicans. That's what I'm saying. It's like this one, I feel like they're cornered from all angles, right? The partial transcript released by the Trump administration, his own confession, Mulvaney's confession, Giuliani's admission, all these sterling public servants, plus Volker, plus Sondland, who I don't think is going to go to jail for nobody. That bird is going to squeak and sing.
Dude, Sondland's already signed his own arrest warrant, basically.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's too much. It's just too much.
Well,
and so, and then Trump's own tweets, which, as we've already mentioned, do not help his case at all.
So right now, of course, we have Volker and Morrison testifying. We'll update you more next week because we don't know what's going to happen. Volker is, I'm the most intrigued to see what he says. Morrison too, but to a lesser degree. Morrison's kind of squirrely, but he doesn't know that much anyway. And Volker has, I feel very confident saying he committed perjury several times in his deposition. And from his opening statements today, is saying things that are not true now as well. But they're more minor-ish, sort of, compared to the guy up tomorrow, Gordon Sondland. Gordon Sondland is, I think, in very deep trouble.
Very deep.
If you want pizzazz, tomorrow we'll likely have it.
All right, so tell me, guys. I mean, sorry to cut you off, but explain to me why Gordon Sondland is in deep doo-doo.
Because he said a lot of not true things under oath. So here's his story. And what's interesting is trying to go through it and try to figure out, like, why. Like, there are things he says that do not appear to be true. Some are definitely not true. I'm still a little uncertain about why he's taking the tact he did. I think once we know more about Giuliani and the calls in August and August 11th, that will probably explain it. But his story at the deposition, even though the Republicans came out and were like, oh, it blew up the impeachment inquiry, it was so great for Trump. Actually, Sondland's extremely damaging still for Trump. Sondland was in there to protect himself, which involved protecting Trump, but first and foremost, he was protecting himself. And he, like, confirmed, absolutely confirmed, that yes, there was absolutely a quid pro quo between Trump and Ukraine. Like, hands down, we now know for a absolute fact, there's no one who disputes it, they just don't talk about it, that there was quid pro quo. and yet Republicans are out there like, oh, like, this impeachment inquiry has found nothing. This impeachment inquiry is looking for a quid pro quo doesn't exist, when literally it's been confirmed. Sondland's story is not good for Trump, but he is protecting himself still, which is interesting. But here's the basic outline of what he said so far in the deposition. He says that as the EU ambassador, he was, you know, got involved in Ukraine policy for some reason. And back in May, he and Volker and Senator Johnson and someone else I'm blanking on went to the Oval Office to meet with Trump about the newly elected Ukrainian President Zelensky. And they were all excited. They thought this would be a great chance for American foreign policy in Ukraine, make new partnerships, really push some initiatives forward. They get to the Oval Office, and Trump is, he's just being a bit crabby. You know, hasn't had his nap. He's grouchy and angry, and he doesn't like Ukraine. He tells them Ukraine's awful and did things to him. And he won't engage with them on policy. He won't tell them anything substantive or hear what they're trying to say to him. All Trump will tell them is, talk to Rudy. Go talk to Rudy. Go talk to Rudy. So according to Sondland, he did not talk to Rudy. He decided that he did not want to get involved with that. I mean, if that's true, good call for him. I mean, yeah, no one should get involved with Rudy. But poor Rick Perry and Ambassador Volker take charge of communicating with Rudy about...
Poor Rick Perry.
Poor Rick Perry got the short straw and he had to do this. And from there, that's where the two parallel paths diverge. Or as the caster put it in the testimony with Bill Taylor and George Kent, it was outlandish, but not as outlandish as it could have been. These parallel paths where you've got, on the one hand, the normal U.S. foreign policy channels, and on the other hand, you have this Giuliani working through Volker and Sondland to some extent. And according to Sondland, he just had no idea whatsoever at first that there was any kind of quid pro quo going on. It was only after the July 25th call that he realized that there was a quid pro quo involved with the White House visit, and that in order to get the White House visit the Ukraine wanted, it would have to agree to the investigations of Burisma in the 2016 election. But of course, like Volker says, Sondland also says he had no idea that Burisma was code for Biden.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. For instance, on July 25th in Ukraine, when Sondland was over there, gave an interview to a Ukrainian news channel about the phone call between Zelensky and Trump. And he said, with regards to Zelensky's much-wanted White House meeting, that, quote, certain things that Ukrainians have to do. There's preconditions to anything. Yeah. Asked to explain this at his deposition, Sondland said, at the time, I probably meant, you know, getting the schedule straight, getting the commitment. I think that was when we were still on the corruption continuum, on the plain vanilla corruption part of the continuum. His story is that it only after that point later transformed from just corruption to Burisma 2016. And only in like September did they finally learn that, oh my gosh, Burisma is actually Biden.
Who would have thought? I mean, because, you know, Burisma is all, you know, just so happened that Hunter Biden, Biden's son, was sitting there on the Burisma chair. I mean, this is just what a coincidence, the jackpot of the Republicans. And it's also interesting that, you know, Jennifer Williams, who also testified, who was the VP to Pence, you know, Zelensky and the Ukrainians, she testified, were fully aware that the funds were being withheld until they started cracking down and investigating.
on Burisma.
Did she testify to that?
Well, she testified to the following, that the first thing that was brought up by Zelensky to Pence in that September meeting was the funds. The first thing.
Yes.
And New York Times reporting says that Ukraine was aware early in the summer that the funding was held up for the investigation. So Ukraine knew what was happening. Zelensky knew what was happening. Everyone seems to know what was happening, what was really happening, except, of course, the Republicans who were doing it. They're like, oh, Burisma. Who would have thought? Everybody.
So Sondland's story is that the text that you were talking about earlier, Siraj, between him and Taylor, where
right.
Taylor says, are we now saying that aid is dependent on the investigations? And Sondland texts back and says, there's no quid pro quo. Well, he expanded on how that came to be. And after he got the text from Bill Taylor, he called Trump. And his story is from his opening statement in the depot was, I called President Trump directly. I asked the president, what do you want from Ukraine? The president responded, nothing. There is no quid pro quo. The president repeated, there is no quid pro quo. No quid pro quo multiple times. It was a very short call, and I recall that the president was in a really bad mood. Later, Sondland said, it was a very quick conversation. Trump said, I want nothing. I want no quid pro quo. I want Zelensky to do the right thing. So, of course...
That's...
Why are you laughing, Siraj?
No, because, like, I mean, that obviously this is very self-contradictory. You say you don't want the quid pro quo, yet you're saying you want basically what you want.
Yeah.
It's exactly... It's like basically every single... You know, why'd you know this? I mean, every single Desi mom or for like my wife, every Jewish mom, you know, you're like, I don't want you to do this, but do this for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like it's
that wise guy talk, you know. It's a very mafioso type of speaking.
Yeah, mob bosses, yeah, no, and passive aggressive moms.
No mob boss ever says, like, no mob boss or no criminal says, according to the penal code for extortion, I want you to, you know, do these elements. That is what I want.
Yes.
It's exactly what Michael Cohen said. He goes, there's a language.
It's like Volker testifying in the deposition that there was no quid pro quo, but there were preconditions to get the White House meeting they wanted. Now, the GOP has been saying, like, oh, Sondland proves that there's no quid pro quo. Trump himself said there's no quid pro quo because, I mean, obviously, if Trump said it didn't happen, then case closed, right? But
right.
It is remarkably similar to something else we've heard before and testimony before Congress.
All right. Well, you've suggested that the president sometimes communicates his wishes indirectly. For example, you said, quote, Mr. Trump did not directly tell me to lie to Congress. That's not how he operates, end quote. Can you explain how he does this?
Sure. It would be no different if I said, that's the nicest looking tie I've ever seen, isn't it? What are you going to do? You're going to fight with him? The answer is no. So you say, yeah, it's the nicest looking tie I've ever seen. That's how he speaks. He doesn't give you questions. He doesn't give you orders. He speaks in a code. And I understand the code because I've been around him for a decade.
And it's your impression that others who work for him understand the code as well?
Most people, yes.
That tie is the most beautiful tie in the world. There is no quid pro quo. Like, that's how Trump gives his instructions. Sondland, it seems like, was not quite up to the mob talk and maybe didn't catch on quite so fast, but he caught on well enough. I mean, this is evidence of wrong, that Trump's conscious of his wrongdoing. He knows he can't say quid pro quo. He knows that quid pro quo is the legal danger, let alone impeachment danger.
Right.
Sondland's not the one who even asked about the quid pro quo. That was all Trump spontaneously bringing it up when he gets this call from Sondland.
I mean, here's the thing. It's Trump seems to have just done this for so long in the private sector, and he's trying to bring that same mentality to the White House, to public office, and the world just doesn't work like that. I mean, maybe it does. I don't know. But maybe he's just really bad at it, or he just doesn't surround himself. No, I mean, we know this for sure. He doesn't surround himself with the best people in many cases. And it just so happens that they weren't careful and they all got picked up at one point or another over the last 2.5 years. And all of a sudden, boom, like he's basically trying to dig his way out of this. Yeah, he's only digging himself deeper. It's just like as an American, it is sad to see a president sort of go about it this way.
The mob boss way.
I mean, like the global perspective is like, oh, every president in the world or every world leader is in many ways like a crook or a criminal. And yeah, that might be the case, but you know, we've always sort of prided ourselves as a country on sort of having that, you know, at least having like a moral compass to not like just openly and brazenly do something that not only violates the law, but is just inherently wrong. And also just sort of makes us the butt of every joke to the world. I mean, it's just unfortunate.
No, Siraj, the world respects us again.
I'm going to get canceled for this, aren't I?
So anyway, Sondland's got some problems. There's a lot of evidence that he was lying about a lot of things. For instance, well, we already know that he was incorrect about his claim that the quid pro quo was only for the White House visit and the... So initially, he did say it at first, he did say outright that there was preconditions, conditions, requirements, various other euphemisms for quid pro quo on the White House visit Zelensky wanted. In exchange, Trump asked for the Biden investigation and the 2016 investigation. What he didn't say is that there was quid pro quo based on the withheld military aid. But then he did his little addendum after the fact. Like, actually, I recall now. In fact, there was a quid pro quo for the military assistance. Problems don't stop there, though, because we also have, for instance, Ron Johnson, Senator Ron Johnson, who, like a month ago now, a lifetime ago now, said that when he'd spoke to Sondland in September, trying to find out why the heck this military assistance had been slowed up, it wasn't being paid out, Sondland told him, oh, it's conditioned on the Biden investigations. Something, of course, Sondland did not admit to saying. And then there is, of course, Holmes, the new witness that came forward and already testified in the skiff on Friday. And so what Holmes said is that Holmes is in the State Department. He's stationed in Ukraine. And he was present on July 26th after the Trump-Zelensky call. And he went to a lunch with Sondland after some meetings with Zelensky. And then Sondland met privately with Andrei Yermak, Zelensky's aide. And they go to lunch. They get a bottle of wine. Sondland tells them stories about marketing in the hotel business and, you know, how he marketed his hotels. And then he's like, at the table in the restaurant in front of everyone, oh, by the way, I got to call Trump now. So there at the restaurant, he gets a cell phone, dials up the White House, gets shuttled around, so he gets put on the phone with Trump. And you know this dude was trying to show off that he could talk to the president. Like, right. That's the only possible explanation.
Why would you got to flex that hard? If you can get through to the president, doesn't matter which president, you got to give him a call in front of your buddy.
Not even like the random Ukrainian embassy staffers. You better flex in front of them.
Gotta.
Sondland definitely had to. And of course, Trump being Trump, he yells a lot. He yells so much that people around the Sondland can hear him. And they hear Sondland and Trump have a conversation. Have you read about it, Siraj?
I peeped it a little. And I do think it's, you know, look, the automatic defense of that, at least for Trump, is going to be like, oh, no, that conversation didn't happen. Or like, oh, no, he wasn't yelling at him. We'll see when Sondland testifies under oath. Because it always matters, obviously, you and Waj, both lawyers, you know how this deal works more than the average American. When you actually are testifying in front of Congress, it absolutely matters what you're saying in front of them. Because if it doesn't match up or if it's discovered that you're lying, you're absolutely, you're screwed. I mean, I think it's not going to work out well for Trump in this regard.
And it's not going to work out well for Sondland either. But so keep in mind, it wasn't just Holmes who heard this conversation. Apparently, there's a second staffer, forgetting her name right now. So there'll be two witnesses eventually who testify they heard this. And
could be more.
And but what did Trump have to say when he was asked about this alleged conversation? Well, here's what his response was.
I know nothing about that. First time I've heard it. The one thing I've seen that Sondland said was that he did speak to me for a brief moment, and I said, no quid pro quo under any circumstances, and that's true. The other, I've never heard this. In any event, it's more secondhand information, but I've never heard it.
Do you recall having a conversation with
I don't recall. No, not at all. Not even a little bit. The only thing, and I guess Sondland has stayed with his testimony, that there was no quid pro quo. Pure and simple.
But at least Zelensky loves Trump's ass, according to Sondland. That's all that matters. He loves your ass.
You know, when I first saw that Chiron and I was just like in passing, I wasn't sure if he was actually talking about the like your actual like posterior. I thought he was legit talking about like, oh, he really loves your ass. Like to the untrained eye, that's like, all right, we're in the Me Too era. This is like, that's just, why are you saying that?
I mean, either way, why are you saying that? But
yeah, no, I mean, like, but
but have you seen Trump's ass? So that's clearly unrealistic.
What's worse is it was an unsecure phone susceptible to being intercepted by, I don't know, Russians openly saying this. So like David Holmes and at least one other person could hear it. And apparently, you know, he doesn't give a shit about Ukraine.
Oh, yeah, that too.
Also, it's on the set. That's huge. Right? Holmes said that Trump said he didn't give a shit about Ukraine.
He just cares about the Biden investigation, which he claims in his testimony he never heard about the Biden part of it. Anyway, the phone call between Sondland and Trump involves Trump saying, are they going to do the investigations? And Sondland says, yeah, they're going to do the investigations. Zelensky loves your ass. I got to say, when I first saw the news about the Holmes testimony, it came at the same time as there was an article about Kilimnik, the Ukrainian-Russian aide to Manafort. And his quote that was the headline was like, Kilimnik says that like they don't love Ukraine. It's just a dildo they can use to fuck each other with. And that was like side by side with like Zelensky loves Trump's ass. And I'm like, what the hell just happened today?
My God.
It's always the most homophobic administrations who are obsessed with like asses and dildos. I'm just saying.
Maybe they're just it's a closeted.
Yeah. The impeachment hearing it didn't just bring pizzazz, it brought its jazz fingers for that day. So we also have right now Volcker, who is still testifying. I'm still missing it, so we're going to end this soon.
He is not helping the Republicans.
He's not helping anyone, as far as I can tell. But his opening statement has already changed because in his deposition, he said that in this infamous July 10th meeting, we'll get more into next week, no one brought up the investigations. And his opening statement now, well, Volcker acknowledges that, yes, Sondland did bring them up. So at every single witness, Sondland's hole gets deeper and deeper. It should be fun. 9 a.m. Don't miss it. C-SPAN's place to be.
Word up.
Wow, you actually went with the word up. It's a nice throwback to the late 80s, Suraj. Very impressive.
Hey, man. Gotta pay homage to when I was born. 87, baby.
And I think it was officially retired when Vanilla Ice said word to your mother when accepting the Grammy. So that was 1992. That's when it was buried.
Well, us millennials, now we have our own Watergate hearings that we can tell people about 30 years from now and how we excitedly watched congressional testimony for hours on end.
With pizzazz and jazz hands and great optics.
Man, there should be like watch parties like 9 a.m. somewhere. I probably wouldn't go, but it'd be fun. So that's all for this week. Now I'm going to turn to my marathon C-SPAN watching and find out what Volcker and Morrison are saying.
A big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan. And you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is @45thpod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.